Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the greatest challenges to U.S. national security in the next few years, and are we really prepared to meet them? Retired General John Abizade served as head of the U.S. Central Command, which includes Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan, among other countries, from July of 2003 until March of last year. He says Islamic extremism, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and our continued dependence on oil put us at risk, and he believes U.S. troops may be deployed to the Middle East for another half century to deal with those issues. Since his retirement, Abizade has served as a fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's in town today to support the efforts of the Triad Fund of the Dallas Foundation. Triad stands for Texas Resources for Iraq and Afghanistan Deployment. General Abizade, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here.
You have famously called this the Long War. Can you talk about what that term means?
Well, it's very interesting. I've called it the Long War, and people hate that term, and I understand why they hate it. But what it really means is that we've got a long-term struggle ahead to help the people in the Middle East against this very difficult extremist movement that's moving forth in the region, not only from Sunni Islamic extremism, such as led by bin Laden and al-Qaeda, but also Shia extremism as led by the nation state of Iran. Of course, these things are incompatible, but they are movements. They are ideological activities that we need to pay attention to, and they're going to be around for some time. The question is, how do we confront it in a way that protects the good interests of the good people in the region while at the same time protecting the interests of our own country and the globalizing planet?
You say that people hate that term, and it's obvious because we'd all like to be in and out quickly. You stayed as head of CENTCOM for longer than anybody in history. There were many people when you took that assignment that would have assumed that we would be sort of in and out of Iraq and Afghanistan long before it would have been time for you to retire. Did you think at any point that you would be able to sort of see this to its completion before you were ready to leave?
You know, you're always very hopeful, especially as a soldier. You tend to be optimistic about the ability of things to move forward. But the resiliency of these movements, the difficulties of institution building, in particular in a place like Afghanistan and a place like Iraq, really caused things to move a lot less slowly than you might imagine. I've had a lot of experience in the Middle East. I thought it would take a while, but the pace of events when an armed enemy is present really tends to be much slower than we think. And, of course, we Americans want things to be over within a five-second soundbite. And in reality, when you deal with problems in the Middle East, they are pervasive, they're long-term, and they're very, very difficult. What we also have to beware of is some sort of a perfect solution to the problem. There is no perfect solution to the problem, and there are different ways that we can approach it. I think we've got a great opportunity to approach it differently with new administration coming up in November and then being sworn in January.
You've said 25 to 50 years before we're likely to be able to pull out of the region in terms of physical deployments there. Do you imagine that the U.S. will still have superpower status at that point?
Yeah, I certainly believe the U.S. will have superpower status at that point. There is no country with the great military, industrial, economic power. Certainly we go through periods of ups and downs, but American power for the 21st century is what will lead us to a better outcome in the 21st century. So I certainly am confident that that's true. And I'd also like to say, please don't misunderstand what I say about having to stay in the Middle East for a long time. I don't mean that we have to stay in the Middle East for a long time with 250,000 troops like we do right now. I mean that over time, American interests will be solved to a better degree than it currently is by being able to help the people in the region help themselves. And I think ultimately this means we'll have to bring our military power down in the region while increasing the amount of soft power that's deployed out there. So while American leadership will be indispensable, it doesn't need to be at the same level of military involvement that we currently see. As a matter of fact, I would envision in the next couple of years you'll start to see things coming down.
Before the war, General Shinseki was all but sort of laughed off the podium by Secretary Rumsfeld when he said it would take hundreds of thousands of soldiers deployed to really do things right in Iraq. In 2006, you testified that, in fact, he was right. Did you agree with him at the time?
Well, yeah, I don't exactly recall saying that he was right, but I don't dispute your research. I do think that it's a very, very complicated problem. And, of course, the issue of troops in Iraq have to do with an equation that's just not American. It's American troops plus allied troops plus Iraqi troops. And while the number of American troops is actually limited by the size of the United States Army, the other conditions, Iraqi troops plus other allied troops, I think could have been a lot more robust. And it was very difficult to recruit other countries to send troops into Iraq. And once they did send them into Iraq, because it was such a dangerous operating environment, they tended not to want to keep them there too long. And then the decision was made to bring the Iraqi army down to zero and then start over again. Those three issues taken together created a deficit of military strength on the ground at the early stage of the campaign. But we shouldn't underestimate the difficulties, even if we had had the entire United States Army there, of stabilizing a country like that with its ethnic, economic, political divisions that are so deep and that had been essentially kept under wraps by the brutal dictatorship of Saddam Hussein.
Retired CENTCOM Commander General John Abizade is my guest. He's in town for an event of the Triad Fund, the Texas Resources for Iraq-Afghanistan Deployment. Let's talk about Prime Minister al-Maliki. Do you think he has the ability, even the sort of personal charisma, to unite the country?
It's probably the $64,000 question. Can he do it? And, of course, we should beware of the idea that any one country is going to be shaped by any one particular human being. It's really about the institutions of Iraq. Will they be capable enough of moving the country into the 21st century? And can Maliki, as the prime minister, go beyond a narrow sectarian view of what's going on in the country? It's been mixed so far. He has been slow off the mark. He has done some things that have given people to believe that he's a Shia first and an Iraqi second. I believe that's probably unfair criticism. In the most recent operations down in Basra, he was decisive. You can always argue about how things went down there, but I think he personally got involved. He got the armed forces involved. If you look at the long view, things in Basra seem to be moving in a positive direction. He's moved politically forward in some positive ways. And I think we should be realistic that he is capable of leading the country forward, but he must be a man of broad tolerance. He must bring in his Sunni countrymen. He must bring in his Kurdish countrymen, and he must move against the militias that will otherwise plague Iraq the same way they've plagued countries such as Lebanon.
When you have characterized the things that are the greatest threats to our security in the region at this point, you have separated Sunni extremism from Shia extremism. Now, clearly we know that they're against each other, but does the strategy need to be fundamentally different dealing with one as opposed to the other?
I think it needs to be different because when you look at Sunni extremism in particular, it's a very interesting sort of movement that's developed. It's one that has developed with al-Qaeda at its core, but it's not a nation state. It's a networked organization. It is linked through the virtual space in a very, very interesting sort of way. They manage to recruit, train, gain money, proselytize all through modern communications means, yet they don't have what I would call a geographic base of operations. And so it's a movement that we need to pay attention to. It's a modern movement. It's a 21st century movement, but the source of its ideology is back in the 7th century. And so thinking about how you deal with that involves a different set of skills. You have to help people get away from some of the proselytizing of extremist preachers by investing in education, by investing in other methods that give them a sense for hope for the future. You've got to use counter-terrorist forces when you find their nodes and go after them, but you need to do it in a very precise way so you're not attacking and causing collateral damage among people that are innocent. It's a very difficult thing to wage war against an amorphous enemy such as that, and it will require continued new thinking about how we do it. And it's different from Shia extremism, which essentially is embedded in the thinking of the nation-state of Iran, which creates a much different problem. On the one hand, al-Qaeda is difficult to deter. On the other hand, Iran is not difficult to deter because it's a nation state and it has many power centers that aren't necessarily attached to the theology of the mullahs.
So you know where your targets are.
Well, I mean, if you have to hold them at risk, you can hold them at risk. But I'd say the right strategy for dealing with the Iranians is to make sure they understand that there are limits to what we in the international community will expect. Don't want them to develop a nuclear weapon. We don't want them to bother their neighbors. We don't want them to foment unrest in the various Shia communities around the region. Unfortunately, they're working to develop a nuclear weapon. They're creating foment and unrest in various areas. Just look in southern Lebanon and the areas of Beirut here recently, where the Iranians, again, I'm sure, have decided that they can turn up the heat to create problems in the region. The Iranians are also very vocal about talking about the destruction of the state of Israel, at least as far as their president, Ahmadinejad, believes. Now, I'd also say, though, that as you look at the Iranian people, they're people with a deep and rich culture. They have a belief in their nationhood that is not necessarily domineering. They are tired of the mullah government, and I think over time they'll move towards a better future.
You've said that in the same way that we've learned to live with a nuclear China and a nuclear Russia, we could learn to coexist with a nuclear Iran. What are the limits of your tolerance for Iran having nuclear weaponry?
Well, I have very low tolerance for it. And as always, you know, when you say something at a conference, sometimes it gets misinterpreted. I think we should do everything we can to keep Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. And the international community should work very hard to prevent that from happening. The worst thing I can think of is nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, the most stable of all global areas, the part of the world that we depend upon the flow of energy to keep the globalizing planet moving. And a nuclear weapon in Iran would certainly lead to a nuclear weapon being developed in the Arab Sunni states at some point or other. And it would create a dynamic that would cause the Israelis to have to think about what has to be done with regard to that threat. But on the other hand, we shouldn't kid ourselves. We did manage to live with the Soviet Union for an awful long time under very, very difficult circumstances, and deterrence worked. It can work against the Iranians, but we should not move down that road in the 21st century. We should move in the opposite direction. We should move to reduce the levels of nuclear weapons, not only in the Middle East, but everywhere, so that we reduce the chances of miscalculation.
Oil hit record highs yesterday. It's just under $127 a barrel. To what extent do those incredibly high prices, even right now, without any kind of military aggression against Iran, actually deter the U.S. from taking military action?
Well, I think the United States will do whatever it has to do to protect its vital interests. The question in the Middle East is always deciding where those lines happen to be, what lines are vital and what lines are not so vital. The price of oil in and of itself is certainly important not only to us but to the global economy. But the price of oil doesn't necessarily threaten our vital interests. It doesn't keep us from taking military action if we need to. But it's very important that we understand that the dynamic with regard to the price of oil is such that we first and foremost need to develop other resources here.
Retired CENTCOM Commander General John Abizade is my guest. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is retired CENTCOM Commander General John Abizaid. He's currently a fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's in town to support the efforts of the Texas Resources for Iraq-Afghanistan Deployment Fund. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. General, what do we need to do to avoid an echo generation of anti-U.S. sentiment, you know, 15, 20 years down the road, people who associate the U.S. occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan with extraordinary deprivation?
I think the most important thing to do is we've got to change our weighting in the Middle East, in particular, to get away from such a heavy military involvement and move towards more diplomatic, political, economic, educational, informational action that really puts the tools in the hands of the good people in the region to resist this extremist trend. I believe that that can be done. I believe it should be done. How you shift your balance from where you are now with nearly 250,000 troops in the broader region to where we need to be, we should remember that before 2001 we had about 25,000 troops in the region. So I think over time we can drop the troop levels, and it really requires not only more American soft power be employed, but also more international soft power. And it's also going to take some more action from the people in the region to step up to the plate and take some responsibility to confront the extremists on their own. The question is, how can we help them help themselves? But we shouldn't kid ourselves that somehow or other we can dominate or control the region. Didn't work for the Romans, didn't work for the British, it won't work for us, but we can shape the region in a way that's good for the globalizing planet, and we want it to, after all, stabilize on our terms and not on bin Laden's.
Is it appropriate to expect U.S. troops on the ground to exercise more soft power than they're currently doing?
Well, the truth is, Chris, that U.S. troops on the ground have been exercising an awful lot of soft power. It's amazing to see them operate. One minute you'll see an infantry platoon in combat being about as ferocious as anybody you've ever seen, and a couple hours later, they'll be working on trying to fix up a local school. It's a very difficult and complicated position for young soldiers to be in. It creates a lot of stress and a lot of strain. But they have done a great job in employing soft power, but they're not necessarily trained to do that. And we shouldn't rely on our military to employ soft power. We should rely on our State Department, the USAID. We should also ask private enterprise to do work in the region with the people in the region where investment will help resist some of this extremist tendency that's going on. So I think that our troops have done a magnificent job in confronting the dangers and the challenges that have been posed. But now as we move forward, we need to really mobilize ourselves in a way that doesn't put the burden on a small group of Americans that wear the uniform.
You're in town for a Triad Fund event. Can you talk about what they do?
Well, the Triad Fund is designed to help veterans in Texas in particular to help them find a place where they can deal with either financial, medical, mental, whatever the type of problems they may have as a result of their many stressful deployments. And, of course, you know, we have the active force and a big amount of troops up there in Fort Hood, Texas, not far from here. A matter of fact, the largest group of troops anywhere in the United States, and got an awful lot of people from the Texas National Guard and reserve units here in Texas. And it's very important that we understand that we've got to help these people as they reintegrate into the society in a way that makes sure that we can take care of their needs. There's nothing more important to the nation than soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that are willing to fight for the country when the country calls upon them. And when they come out of service, we need to continue to help them. The Dallas Foundation, through the Triad Fund, is doing precisely that. They're linking up kids of fallen parents with counseling. They're linking up kids of deployed parents with counseling. They're linking up soldiers that have found some mental problems that they're finding difficult to deal with healthcare professionals. These are all extremely important sorts of things to do. And they're also helping veterans find jobs, which is something that we all need to think about how we can help them integrate back into the country.
I think very few people would disagree that the work that the Triad Fund does is important and really wonderful. But I wonder if groups like this don't sort of let the federal government off the hook. Isn't this a function that the government and our tax dollars should be providing for the soldiers who are serving us?
Well, the government needs to do a lot, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that the government can do anything, everything. Government can't be all things to all people, and it's up to us, those of us that are on the outside, to help these people help themselves in a way that we can. Some people get lost through the crack through no fault of the government. Sometimes the government's too bureaucratic to find them. And really, it comes down to average people on the street every day trying to do something to help veterans, and I think that's what the Triad Fund's all about. So I think it's a combination of government funding and private funding that will help people, and I think that's vitally important that we do that for our veterans.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is retired CENTCOM Commander General John Abizaid. Our telephone number, as I said, is 800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go first to Mac in Dallas. Hi, Mac.
I have a question.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I've been curious about what happened to General Shinseki after he made his remarks about needing 300,000 men. Did he get busted back to a supply depot or out to pasture or what?
Well, General Shinseki served out his term as Chief of Staff of the Army. He retired, and he is a respected person in the military today that goes around and helps talk about different political military activities around the world, and he's got a lot of respect in the U.S. Army. So General Shinseki continues to do his duty for the good of the country, as I think all of us would have expected.
We have an email from Jeremy who thanks you for your service and says, could you discuss the steps that forces in Iraq are taking to deter the seemingly culturally ingrained corruption among Iraqi officials?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And, of course, this cultural issue concerning corruption is not just a problem in Iraq. It's a problem in most of the Middle East, and it's certainly a problem in Afghanistan. It's tough for soldiers to be able to deal with the corruption levels. The most important thing they do is they work to try to help the new Iraqi judicial system become more and more effective. We've actually been very slow in building what I would call the rule of law within Iraq. When a dictator rules a country, the rule of law doesn't necessarily go very far. And so probably one of the most important things that has to be done in Iraq is to move forward on the rule of law. Recently here, I talked to a commander of forces that was up in an important oil-producing region in the north, and he worked on some very, very important anti-corruption action where he essentially used American forces to help Iraqi police to dislodge some of the mafia-type activities that were going on to extort money for oil. And I think we have to continue to do that sort of thing up to a point. But the cultural problems between us and the people in the Middle East are pretty significant. There's very few Americans that know the language, very few Americans that really understand the culture. Of course, a number of troops that have been over there over and over again are starting to become very culturally adept. But we've got to really work on our cultural awareness, not only for matters such as corruption, but for just about everything that goes on in the region, how tribes work, how people work, how the whole system of revenge takes hold of communities, and it's quite important that we close the cultural gap.
You're the highest-ranking Arab-American in the history of the U.S. military. Is that right?
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily true, because there have been other Lebanese-Americans and Syrian-Americans that have risen to the rank of four-star general, but I certainly am an Arab American, a Lebanese American, and I'm proud of it.
What did that? How did that change your understanding of the situation that we were in? That what did you understand that maybe someone else in your position without that cultural background wouldn't have?
Well, the interesting thing is I came from a Christian Lebanese family. They came over in the 1870s. Nobody spoke Arabic in my family when I was growing up, but we did have the culture, and so the culture permeates even though the language doesn't. Then the Army taught me how to speak Arabic. Then I served in the Middle East for about half my life. And so that opportunity to get to know the culture and get to know the people helped me, and it will help others, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that we can be an American one day and an Arab the next. And I'm certainly proud of my Arab culture, but on the other hand, it's very, very clear to me that what we have to do is keep training people in how to operate in that culture in a way that respects people. In many regards, this battle that we're facing out there is all about respect. Do we respect the culture? Do we respect the people? Certainly there are many enemies out there that we must confront with military force, and we need to do that. We need to not be afraid to do that. But at the end of the day, this idea of mutual respect, I think, will eventually restore the region to a better outcome.
Is it disrespectful to assume that, U.S.-style democracy works best everywhere?
Well, I think we should be careful about this notion of U.S. democracy. U.S.-style democracy is being something that fits well into an Islamic culture. In our culture, we have a strong belief of the separation of church and state. In their culture, they have a strong belief that the church is the state. And a statement like that is pretty important for people to comprehend. It creates a huge dissonance between the two cultures that people have to pay attention to. So I would say we need to ask for governments to be more accountable to their people within their cultural norms, as opposed to, say, have a election tomorrow and you'll be fine. We should note that we insisted on elections in Palestine, and we ended up having Hamas, which is a very non-democratic organization, come to power in a way which has driven the peace process far away from realization.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. My guest is retired General John Abizaid. Let's go next to Syracuse in Dallas. Hi, Syracuse.
Yes, I'm a naturalized U.S. citizen, and I come from Nigeria originally. My name actually COC. My concern is that lately we've been hearing that China has been making military inroads into Africa. And how does the United States put this in check to make sure that Africa does not come under Chinese communism or military influence?
Thanks for your call. Any thoughts on that, General?
Well, certainly part of my command was in the Horn of Africa and included Egypt, Sudan, Ethiopia, Kenya, Djibouti, etc., Somalia. It's a vital area of importance to the United States. Resources there are very clearly under competition between countries such as China and others that we need to pay attention to. I don't think the Chinese intend to dominate Africa. I don't think anybody can dominate Africa other than the Africans. But what we do need to do is help the African nations move forward in a way that gives them the ability to resist the inroads of extremism, especially in the Muslim African countries along the central belt of Africa. So it's clearly in our interest to work with the African nations. And one of the things that we've done recently is form an African command, which is an analog to the Central Command, except it takes up the African continent. The idea there is not to dominate the area militarily, but to work with the people to give them the tools to help them help themselves. I mean, Africa has a host of problems, and it also has tremendous opportunity to move forward in a positive way in the 21st century. If we ignore Africa, we ignore it at our own risk, but we have to operate there wisely. And that wise operation means working with the people in the region in a way that develops their resources and their human capabilities to allow them to deal with the tough problems of the 21st century.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Ron in Richardson. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for an excellent show. Kind of dovetailing off, mentioned that Iraq has different traditions than the United States. One of our cornerstone traditions is that the Defense Department does not target propaganda to American citizens. The New York Times recently documented a specific program in which retired military officers were trained, given talking points, and then seated out in the media as cheerleaders for the war. So I have two questions for the general. One, are you part of that program? And number two, do you ever think it's appropriate for the Pentagon to propagandize the American people? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks. First of all, no, I'm certainly not part of any program that comes out of the Pentagon. On the other hand, those of us that are retired military people certainly have a lot of friends and contacts within the Pentagon, and we know people that have been involved in the activities that are going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. We talk to them, we listen to them, and we understand what they're saying. And I don't think it's right for the Pentagon to be involved in propaganda. I mean, what will win this war ultimately will be freedom of the press and truth. But sometimes I know from my own personal opportunities to be fighting in the Middle East that the truth that I understood from day-to-day dealings with the people and the problems of the region did not get adequately translated over here. So it's important for military people that have experience to say what they think. And more importantly, it's important for people to come up with their own conclusion about what to believe.
How free were you to say what you thought when you were CENTCOM commander?
Well, clearly, military commanders stay within the guidelines of the commander-in-chief and the chain of command that the Constitution says that you need to be with. And there is no room for freelancing on opinion. On the other hand, when you're called to testify before Congress, you're expected to give your best judgment as to what you think the situation happens to be in the region, and I tried to do that to the best of my ability. I certainly have a lot more ability to be open in what I say today than I did as a commander. But the commander's most important audience is not the American public, it's the troops in the field. And you must ensure that you give the troops in the field confidence that they can be successful. And so there will be times that you will certainly ensure that you do everything you can to make sure that the message is being reached to them, that their success and their hard work is paying off. And indeed, I believe that's true.
Can you talk about your take on Admiral Fallon's resignation and whether or not that was, in fact, a factor of him disagreeing with the administration about Iran?
I don't think it has to do with Iran per se. I know what the speculation is in the media. I imagine there's probably a whole series of things that cause things to move in their direction. I don't know for sure. But I think Admiral Fallon's a good man who's done his duty for the country for a long time, and that he's decided to move on is his decision.
My guest is retired CENTCOM Commander General John Abizaid. We'll return to our conversation with him in just a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is retired CENTCOM Commander General John Abizaid. He's currently a fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's in town for an event supporting the Texas Resources for Iraq-Afghanistan Deployment Fund, the Triad Fund, which you can find online at triadfund.org. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak next to Sally in Dallas. Hi, Sally.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
You touched on this a little bit, Chris, but I wanted to just take it a little step further. I feel like our country's ill-preparedness for addressing the issues that veterans face upon returning home isn't really new. And I'm just curious about the general's opinion about why do you think history keeps repeating itself in this way? Why haven't we found workable solutions in the past that we can apply moving forward in the future?
That's a terrific question. And when I look at the Veterans Administration in particular, I quickly came to the conclusion about the second or third year of the war that they were very well suited to deal with our World War II and Korea era vets that had more the problems associated with aging than the terrible wounds that our young troops are coming home from in this theater. So it's very important that we think about the future and we come up with a Veterans Administration and a governmental structure that has the ability to really care for people and then hand them off at the particularly delicate times to private corporations, healthcare providers, people that are interested in helping them in a way that's seamless as opposed to one that we're currently doing, which is somewhat difficult to deal with. So I think we're moving in that direction. I think that we need to get more help from the government, and we also need to get more help from the private sector to bind all this together. We can't allow our veterans to fall through the social cracks.
An email from Don in Denton asks, I wonder what thoughts the general may have about how the war in Iraq has impacted the public's trust in military leadership, not the troops, but the leadership.
I think any long-term conflict, especially one that's as difficult as the types of counterinsurgencies and struggles against extremism that we're facing in the Middle East that go on for so long, impact people's trust in the leadership, both political and military. These are very, very difficult problems to deal with. We Americans in particular have long believed in the short war theory, and when we find ourselves in a persistent conflict, we have a difficult time wondering why the leaders just can't fix it. There are very, very difficult circumstances and complicated matters that our leaders need to move through, but I think it's clear that we also have to have a lot of new thinking going on about how to deal with these problems, and I think that will come with a new administration. We should constantly ask ourselves the question, how are we doing and how can we do better, as opposed to just sticking with the current course of action.
Do you think when you say new administration, it could be any of the potential three that exist now?
Yeah, I'm definitely not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm not a political person. So I believe whichever one of them shows up as the president in January of 2009 will find that they will have to move with within the problems as presented in the Middle East, Shia extremism, Sunni extremism, an Arab-Israeli conflict that could get out of control, the price of oil, nuclear proliferation, et cetera, et cetera. And these are difficult things that will require U.S. leadership. Doesn't mean it needs to be U.S. leadership as we currently have done it, but it's not the simple argument that many political types would like us to believe of reinforce or go. It's much more nuanced than that, and it's going to require the wise application of national power and bringing the international community to bear as well.
We have an email from GK who asks, will the Iranian influence in the region grow exponentially if we have a precipitous withdrawal from Iraq?
Iranian influence in the region is certainly very aggressive. And the question is, what's precipitous with regard to bringing down the troop levels in Iraq? I find it actually very difficult to envision that we could immediately start a major withdrawal from Iraq that would essentially leave Iraq completely uncovered. I think were we to do that, which I regard as being very unlikely no matter which candidate becomes president, then we would indeed create a vacuum that would be filled by Iranian power, and it could very well lead to a much more difficult conflict between Sunni and Shia throughout the region, and we should do everything we can to prevent that from happening. On the other hand, I do believe that precipitous withdrawal is a political slogan, and as opposed to what will really happen. What will happen is we'll bring combat troops down over time. We'll increase our training levels. We'll probably increase our counterterrorist levels, and we'll also have to go to new fronts that will develop in the region as the extremist problem moves around. So it will be a period of sustained military activity, but at much lower levels, and hopefully it will be accompanied by sustained soft power activities at affordable levels throughout the region in cooperation with international partners.
With the benefit of hindsight, was it a mistake for us to go into Iraq without UN approval?
Well, it's very clear to me that we have to understand that the Iraq operation was not conducted in the benefit of hindsight. It was conducted in an atmosphere of believing that there were weapons of mass destruction, that there was an evil regime that needed to be changed, where we were daily, ever since 1991, conducting military operations on a very low scale against the Iraqis. And so the status quo couldn't endure for long. I believe that the issue of going to war primarily based on the weapons of mass destruction argument was a mistake. We should have talked about all of the other reasons to remove Saddam from power, and we should have communicated that very, very clearly. And the ironic thing is that while we didn't find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq to the extent that we thought, that the issue of weapons of mass destruction proliferation in the region is a huge issue for the country to grapple with. Consider Pakistan, which is nuclear-armed, that could become unstable as a result of extremist action. And if you could imagine a weapon somehow or other be transferred from a Pakistani military unit to an extremist, it's really one of our worst nightmares. Imagine a weapon being developed by the Iranians in some sort of confrontation with Israel. So weapons of mass destruction in the modern world, in the 21st century, is a major issue. But we so discredited the argument in the initial stages of the operation into Iraq that I think a lot of people believe that they were being lied to. Certainly those of us that were in the operation thought that the Iraqis had a very robust program, thought that they would use weapons of mass destruction against us, and we made all of our military plans with the belief that that was true.
Do you agree with the assessment that the reason that Iran is so aggressively pursuing a nuclear weapon is because they've seen what's happened in Iraq and have sort of surmised that if they have a nuclear weapon, the U.S. will never invade them?
Well, I think people that nations that have nuclear weapons have tremendous problems. North Korea's got a starving population. Pakistan's got an extremist problem. Russia, somehow or other, couldn't hold together as the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are really more of a curse than they are a boon. And Iran developing a nuclear weapon actually will set the stage for a much broader and more deadly conflict in the Middle East, and they should think twice about developing one.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Don in Cook County. Hi, Don.
Hello. First, I want to thank the General Abizé for helping the veterans as they return. I did have a comment about earlier in the program, General. You said that one of the reasons we need to be there with our military presence is the need to keep that oil lifeline available to the global economy. And I guess my comment to that is that we just I think that's the source of our problem, that taking the world ownership of that oil is a mistake, and I'm not sure where we find our justification to do that, and that the real answer here is to disconnect ourselves from that dependency and move away from it. And I'll take my answer on the radio. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I certainly don't believe that we have ownership over the oil problem, but we do have, unfortunately, ownership over the flow of oil from a security standpoint, just because of the nature of our military power and our great reach. I certainly agree with you with regard to we've got to do something different than being dependent upon Middle Eastern oil. We absolutely, for the past 50 years, had an avenue available that could have allowed us to be less dependent, and we chose not to go down that road. I would hope that the new presidential candidates will make it a very important part of their platform to figure out how we're going to get ourselves less dependent on the flow of oil from the Middle East in particular. And the issue is, as I think the caller correctly believes, is that what happens in the Middle East is that our great dependence upon oil from that region limits our geostrategic maneuver space. And in order to regain some of that maneuver space, we've got to reduce our dependence. But I'm also a realist. It's a long ways off before we'll have to come to a solution about Middle Eastern oil.
Do skyrocketing prices do that more effectively than any kind of public policy?
Well, skyrocketing prices certainly create an economic incentive. And that economic incentive is very, very important. But what happened in previous occasions when we had skyrocketing prices, the prices stopped skyrocketing.
They fell back down,
and we all said, happy day. We're able to move forward without having to do what we need to do. The truth of the matter is that regardless of the price of oil, we need to provide incentives that allow for alternative energy sources to move forward in the country. Otherwise, we become absolutely captive of these geopolitical issues from countries that are controlling oil resources, and we shouldn't allow that to happen.
My guest is former CENTCOM commander, General John Abizade. Let's speak next to Roger in Highland Village. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I wanted to congratulate the general on his even-handed views, and I have a question for you. I thought it was really enlightening to hear you say the difference between Western thought and Eastern thought, separation of church and state. but I want to take it a level deeper than that. What do you think of the premise of Iran? Because certainly taking Saddam out has created a power vacuum in that part of the world. And I listened to Ahmadinejad speak, and his stature in the world, and being a history buff, it just feels like a second launching of the Persian Empire with no one to stand in his way but us.
Yeah, Roger, thanks for your comment. I think we all need to listen to what Ahmadinejad says. It's very disturbing. It's very worrisome. He's talking about the extinction of the state of Israel. He's talking about expansion of Persian influence. And when he talks, it really does cause me to have great concern about what he's thinking about. But I do get a certain amount of satisfaction knowing that there's many power centers in Iran that are filled with smart thinking people that really want to move forward here into the 21st century. The class of people in Iran that are the entrepreneurs in particular are not real interested in the mullah regime somehow or other upsetting the order of business, transportation, et cetera, and there are other checks and balances in the system as well. So it's interesting when you look inside Iran, you find that of all the countries in the Middle East, if you were to do a popularity poll of the United States, that the Iranians would be in first place. And that's pretty remarkable when you think about the way things have gone with the Iranian government. So there's a big issue between the Iranian people who look for a better future and their government that is looking to go back to the 7th century. I think we need to be aware of that. We need to stay vigilant, but we also need to help the good people in the region move forward in a better way. And I think that's possible to do with some good policies.
General, I think we can all imagine how incredibly stressful the job was that you did as CENTCOM commander. I'm wondering, though, if you had to adjust to not having that kind of direct responsibility and direct power over what was taking place.
Yeah, I've had to adjust to the only staff member on my staff now being my wife, who actually tells me what she thinks. That's a very difficult thing to adjust to. But no, seriously, the most wonderful thing about being a private citizen is you regain your privacy. And you regain your ability to influence the action outside of the context of civil, military, political relationships. And I've endeavored to do that, to try to make people understand what's going on in the region, to make them understand it's just not a matter of Iraq, nor is it just a matter of staying there or leaving there. It's a matter of facing this very, very difficult ideology that's afoot out there. And I believe we can do it with a lot of courage, perseverance, and stick-to-itiveness.
General John Abizaid is in town to support the Triad Fund of the Dallas Foundation. You can learn more about their work in support of military personnel in Iraq and Afghanistan at triadfund.org. General, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.